Welcome to Start to Finish Motherhood, a podcast for those thinking or already single mothers by choice, just looking for practical advice for navigating life's relationships. When you decide to have children on your own, it doesn't mean that you're completely alone. I'm Aisha Jenkins, and I'm partnering with you every step of your journey.
Hey, before we dive in, if this show has added value to your life or provided insight to your parenting journey, you can support it by buying me a coffee. Visit starttofinishmotherhood.com/coffee. Now let's get into this episode. Thinking back on this episode, and life will sometimes throw you curveballs, and you just have to have such a balance or level expectations, because when life intervenes, it can intervene in ways that you could never anticipate. So my thoughts on expectations have simmered and evolved with my tenure in parenting, right? So we have these expectations for how your trying to conceive journey is going to go, how your career is going to go, how parenting is going to go. And it just doesn't always go the way you anticipate it. Life and people happen. So there are some things that you can control, and the rest, at least for me, I had to give over to God, my higher power. Parenting will take you on a whole journey where you have these ideas, and then the children come and you have to rewind and start all the way back from zero. And you have to get to know your children. You have to get to know yourself again, because once you go through the process of becoming a parent, it is like a butterfly emerging from a chrysalis. And I will tell you, I'm still in the process of emerging from the chrysalis. So it is just such a transformative process. And that's each step of the way, from trying to conceive to actually being pregnant in the early stages of parenting. And now we're just kind of in the thick of it. So there are things you can control, and there are very few things you have control over. When I was trying to conceive, it was an early lesson in letting go, especially with my second attempt. You have to let go of what you think your body can and what it will do. So when I was pregnant, I had intrauterine growth restriction. They still don't know what caused it. I think that the age of the uterus somehow does play a role in achieving a healthy, successful pregnancy. And so for some reason, my uterus was not functioning as efficiently. And so baby probably wasn't getting all the nutrients that they needed or in the format. So who knows? But one pregnancy to the next was radically different. There were many times where I had to pause and call on a higher power because things did not go as planned. And it started with my first pregnancy where people were like, oh, your water won't break. Guess what? My water absolutely did break with my first pregnancy at 38 weeks. And then with my second attempt, it was, oh, your numbers are good. You should get pregnant with a few tries. It took me 3 years and 3 miscarriages to get pregnant. With my first pregnancy, I did not have morning sickness, right? With my second pregnancy, I had morning sickness and I was nauseous up to 14 weeks. So each pregnancy, each experience has been different. With my first pregnancy, my baby had to stay in the hospital for an entire week under UV lights because she was jaundiced. With my second pregnancy, with all of the hoopla and the drama leading into the delivery, she was the one who got to come home with me. And so, yeah, it was, you know, at delivery, they were like, if she is under 5 pounds, she has to stay. She was 5 pounds, 12 ounces. She got to go home with me. During my second pregnancy, everything that I thought I knew completely went out the window. I had a subchorionic hematoma at 6 weeks. I was nauseous until 14 weeks. I had gestational diabetes midway through the pregnancy. I had intrauterine growth restriction. My delivery was induced at 39 and a half weeks. And I ended up with a child who needed eye surgery at 12 months during a pandemic. And the first pregnancy was textbook Perfect, right? And so let's not even talk about getting kids into the school system and navigating the school system. I was like, Jesus, take the wheel, because it is just madness. Everything, the wheels came off and the train is about to jump the track. There's nothing you can do but just hold on for dear life. Parenting is such an adventure. And I guess on that note, let's jump into this throwback episode. And then I'll go ahead and link some episodes in the show notes that talk about the number of things that can happen unexpectedly as you are on and in the midst of your journey to becoming a single mother by choice. Enjoy.
So we're going to talk about expectation settings and managing disappointments. So I know for me and a lot of my SMC friends, we're planners, but having had kids, you know that there's just but so much you can plan before serendipity takes over. And so I know many of us will get pregnant during the trying phase, during labor and delivery, during breastfeeding, schooling. We have these ideas of what this should look like, and we set our expectations accordingly. That's how I almost burnt out during this pandemic, because you can't plan for a pandemic, right? So what do you do when life intervenes in the things that you expected to have happen? And then how do you deal with that? And so that's what we're here to talk about today. So today we have a special guest. We've invited Simone, who is a teacher by profession, and she's here today to help us peel back this onion and kind of sift through all of the noise that we might get about expectations and talk a little bit about her approach to parenting. So we'll start with some introductions and we'll have Simone go ahead and introduce herself.
All right. Hi, guys. I'm Simone. I am a mom of one. 19-month-old Kaylin, and I'm an entrepreneur and a writer and a former doula, and as Aisha said, a teacher currently. So the single mom by choice path for me came through tragedy. I was divorced and I had a miscarriage of twins throughout my divorce, and I was wondering if I wanted to really wait for another relationship afterward in order to get pregnant again, and I decided that I didn't. And I did my own IUI at home because I tend to not trust doctors. And so I got pregnant through sperm donation. Mm-hmm. And so here I am as a mom and trying to figure out what I am doing throughout this journey.
So we're going to have to come back to that. I did my IUI on my own. We have some SMCs in the space that are like, yeah, I got a speculum and I got a mirror and I put on the music. And I'm just like, how does that work? Like,
I'll tell you real quick. It involves a mirror, catheter, parenthood is more than what I could have ever imagined. I love my child and I'm grateful every day, but I also understand that, as you said, Aisha, I'm a planner. So when things don't go, obviously I'm a planner, right? I did my own IUI, but when things don't go as planned, I get a little frustrated and I have to regroup and figure out what to do. So I'm excited to share my experience with you guys.
All right, cool. Thank you for sharing your intro. So one of the reasons we brought you on was to talk about those expectations. So you and I have had some conversations behind the scenes and in chat where we talked a little bit about expectations. I talked about some of my disappointments earlier in the season. So let's get into it.
I had a midwife and I fully expected to have a water birth at home. I dilated to about 8 centimeters at home by myself without any medication or anything. And then I ended up staying at 8 centimeters for 24 hours. After that period of time, the midwife recommended that we transfer to a hospital just so that maybe I could get some pain medication. She thought maybe my labor was stalled because I was in too much pain for such a long period of time. And so she was like, maybe if you get some pain medication, you relax enough where you can dilate fully and then give birth vaginally. So we transferred, which was disappointing already and shocking. And I was wondering what was going on. But anyway, I got the pain medication. We turned off the epidural and then I dilated to 10. And then I started pushing. I pushed for 2 hours and Kaylin did not budge. But then the heart rate started falling. And then the doctors were like, you have an option of putting a monitor in Kaylin's head or you have an option of getting a C-section. And so I was like, I'm not going to place a monitor in my newborn's head with no guarantee that's not going to end up in a C-section since I've gone through all of this. So that's how I ended up with what is called a home birth cesarean, where you start off as a home birth and then you end up with a cesarean. And it happens more often than people talk about. And there's actually a good book about it. It's called Home Birth Cesarean. And it's a very disappointing and gut-wrenching experience because, as we talked about, you plan very carefully for this home birth and something goes wrong or something goes left and you don't know. It becomes disappointing because there's so much what ifs, right? Like, what if I had not called the midwife at a certain time? Or what if I had? And a lot of the what ifs involve me thinking that maybe the outcome would have been having that home birth. Or what if I didn't transfer? What if I didn't take the medication? Maybe the medication is what affected the heart rate. There's a lot of questions. Usually people who have home births have a certain belief about the medical system as well, which also influences the trauma that goes into ending up with a whole operation in order to have your baby. I wasn't prepared. I didn't have a bag. I wasn't in a mindset to go to a hospital. Just after the cesarean, I have stairs. If I had been in a mindset to go to a hospital, then maybe I would have thought about how am I going to get back up the stairs? I thought I was going to have my baby in my room and just go to bed.
Right.
I had to ask for an extra day at the hospital. I had to ask to stay.
Okay.
Because I was like, I'm incapable. I was not planning for this. I was not ready to go home with the surgery. So I had to ask for an extra day. I came home. I was able to call my mom. She came out and she was supportive and she fixed some meals for me. That ended quickly. And I had to figure out how to heal by myself with an unexpected surgery. My birth experience was quite traumatic, but it was also really eye-opening about how things don't go as planned, how resilient I am. I was a doula before that as well. So that was also part of my disappointment. I've helped so many women give birth vaginally at home through beautiful experiences. And it was like, what's wrong with me? So I had to really go back and look at myself and be like, nothing is wrong with you. You just had a baby. And
So how did you then unpack the disappointment, right? Okay, so you've got this perfect little being with you. Your body is starting to physically heal. How did you emotionally start to deal with the disappointment, possibly heal from the disappointment? What was going through your head at that time?
I reached out to the group, I think within the first couple of weeks that I had the baby. I was like, is this what this is about? Because I'm at home, I'm stinky, I have breast milk on me, my wound hurt, I'm by myself, I'm disappointed in my birth. I was like, is this what this is about? Like, this is horrible. I was like, parenthood, if this is parenthood, I made a mistake. But that's how I felt. That's how I felt at the time. So I think how I dealt with it was just being honest. Being honest and not trying to make myself feel anything other than what I was feeling was the most healing thing for me. I accept myself fully for where I was at the time. And as I healed from every step, I also found community. Like I said, I found community where people had home birth cesareans because it's not something people talk about. People talk about home births and they have this home birth and it's a beautiful thing and that's wonderful. But even as a doula, I didn't know this was a thing. Like I did not know, I knew that being transferred was a possibility, but not a cesarean. No.
Yeah. I think we need to really start having more honest conversations about the pregnancy, labor and delivery and postpartum period, because I think just being able to name what you're experiencing, like a cesarean home birth or a home birth cesarean, being able to just name it is like huge.
Yeah, when I found out there was other people who had that experience and named it, it took away a lot of that shame.
Yeah.
I felt ashamed. As, like I said, as a doula, I was supposed to have this beautiful birth experience. What happened? And I felt like it must have been me, but no, it wasn't me. It was things happen. And birth is one of those experiences where you're really in the middle of life and death. And anything can go wrong and everything can go right. So I'm not one of those people who say, at least I have a healthy baby, though. I think that honoring your experience through birth and how hard it was and how difficult it was for you is part of honoring yourself. Yeah.
I will say I was excited to go into my second pregnancy and none of it went as planned. I never want to be pregnant again after my experience because I will tell people like my entire second pregnancy was a shit show from the beginning. I think because I went into it having had a couple of miscarriages, my body was already in disarray. And so getting pregnant the second time and getting to a certain point, we were already monitoring me for gestational diabetes because of the disruption to my body to begin with from the miscarriages. I had eased into a pre-diabetic state, which I was not aware of until I got to a clinic that was doing really thorough testing. And one of the testing was the A1C. And so my OB and I discussed, and we knew that if I got pregnant, they would immediately start monitoring me for pre-gestational diabetes to make sure I didn't tip into. So my entire pregnancy, like with my first pregnancy, I got to eat French fries and shakes every time when I had my OB appointment. With this pregnancy, there was none of that. I started off on medication. I started off having to monitor. I started off on a gestational diabetes diet. And for the most part of my pregnancy, I was only having to monitor my blood glucose levels. And then because my overnight blood sugar levels were the ones that were causing the problem, I had to take insulin at night. But I had to fax over my blood glucose readings for most of my pregnancy, but I was able to deal with that. I was able to eat food. It wasn't the most exciting experience, but then right around 32 weeks, 34 weeks, they started worrying about the baby size. And so they were like, okay, nothing to get alarmed about, but come back at the next visit. If there's something, we'll talk about it.
They're like, don't worry, but
you go home and you Google. So anyway, the baby had slipped further in terms of her size. And so they were like, you need to go to the maternal fetal specialist. So I ended up there. The person who gave me the news had absolutely no bedside manner. They couldn't figure out what was going on. They suspected it was a placental issue. But this is the part where I nearly lost it because now I'm about 36 weeks. I've got 4 more weeks. And they're like, okay, so in order to combat gestational diabetes, you have to work out. So I worked out during my pregnancy. They told me baby needs the calories. So you can't do anything extra. You need to go on modified bed rest. You need to conserve calories. So you need to stop working out. And so I stopped working out. But remember, I have gestational diabetes. So they're like, add calories, but it had to be specific calories. So they're like, can't eat sugar. So I can't add carbs. So I had to eat a whole lot of protein and vegetables just to increase my calorie take. I had to drink a protein shake, eat this, don't eat that, thread this little tiny needle. Then I had slipped into gestational diabetes. So added to that, I also had to do insulin during the day. I was done. By the time it was time to deliver, I get to the hospital, insult to injury, they were rationing my popsicles because my blood sugar had to stay in range. And so they would give me half a popsicle and I'm hungry. So they give me half a popsicle and they're like, oh, if your blood level comes down, we'll come back in an hour. We'll take it. We'll give you the other half a popsicle. I was hungry. So anyway, seeing that little face at the end of it, and I'm like, what's up with the placenta? Oh, we can't figure it out. So my entire pregnancy was just a shit show. I was done. All the things that my body went through, I was done.
I think my thoughts are a little complicated. I guess as a doula, I would say I see a lot of pregnant women, now mothers who gave birth, not get the support that they needed to build that supply. And as you said, Tara, a lot of the difficult that you had wasn't really your body. It was the support, right? So if you had a better pumping situation, if you had more time to pump, if you had, I think it comes into play with the support you get from the hospital with your family, the support you get with your family. So the support you get with your family, because even as single moms, we need nobody, and we're going to talk about this later, biological norms, right? Developmental norms and development for even ourselves. No woman is designed to give birth alone. We're not designed to just be by ourselves after it. So we're designed to, if we were, then we would chew our own placentas off and throw away. Like, we're not.
Some people talk about that.
I was ready to eat mine. But what I'm saying is that if we were, we'd be doing all this alone. We're designed to give birth within community. So when we're alone and we're dealing with the stress of breastfeeding, and it can be stressful when we don't take time to take care of ourselves, then we end up with infections. We end up with clogged ducts. We end up with, that's our body just telling us, slow down. This is not the time to do this. So that's one thought. The other thought is that breastfeeding for me, because I had so much grief with my pregnancy and my birth experience, breastfeeding for me was part of my healing. So it was the one thing that I knew that I could do. I knew that nobody else had control over this journey but me. Whereas with birth, the doctors came in and the birth didn't go the way I planned. Breastfeeding was solely between my child and I. There's not one outside force that could change that.
Mm-hmm. So that's such a good point. Yeah.
I felt very much in control of that experience. And even though I had difficulty, like within the first week, first of all, Kaylin didn't latch immediately because of the cesarean. They came out hungry, but I was not ready at the time. They were not ready at the time. But because I had my doula experience, and this is something that I want people to know, that you can hand express, please do not express at the hospital with a breast pump, which was given to me. That is not the right thing to do right after you have a baby. Please hand express your colostrum into a spoon and put it into your newborn's mouth until they latch. Yeah, they try to give you a pump right away.
Uh-huh. No, they didn't do it right away, but I'll go into that. Go.
So what could go wrong? You could, first of all, it's going to hurt. You're going to have pain. Your breasts are not designed for a strong latch at that time.
Yeah, it needs to work up, right?
It needs to be this little tiny mouth that's supposed to be on your breast, not this like toddler latch that's like sucking the life out of you.
I know a lot of women who stopped because of the pain. It was just like, it was too painful.
Yeah, that's too much pain. So that's number one. Number two is that you're going to overproduce. And you're also going to, because your body is saying, oh, I guess your baby needs that other milk. Like
maybe you have
two. We actually should talk about that whole expectation of how much milk to produce, because you will see in the spaces where they're like, oh, I produce 8 ounces of milk for a 3-day-old.
Like, yeah, no, that's not normal. Yeah. You're going to hurt. As like I said, as a doula, this is stuff that I was helping people with. And so I'm grateful that I had this knowledge, because at the hospital, which wasn't part of my plan, remember, at the hospital, they were pushing that on me. Lactation consultants were giving me pumps. And that is a big problem. And yes, that has something to do with me being Black. And it was, and lactation consultants were coming to my room and being like, and doctors were coming to my room being like, oh, we're concerned about the baby eating. We're concerned about the baby. We see that you haven't latched yet. And I'm like, you need to back up and give me space and time. So I think just the one thing that I was prepared with was knowledge, which served me and served my child, because I wasn't trying to supplement. I knew that my body was enough. I know that colostrum is milk. You don't have to wait for your milk to come in. Your milk is in. This is the most.
That's how much they need for their little tummy.
And colostrum is literally gold. Like you cannot get any better than colostrum. Seriously, like the nutritional value of colostrum, you can't even express. It is incredible. So that's something that you don't want to just throw away. You don't want to just waste it. You hand express that thing into a spoon and you put it right into your newborn's mouth until you can latch them on and you can get to a lactation consultant that can actually help you if you're having trouble. That's my recommendation. And that's what I did. And so now we're 19 months in and I'm not ready to stop, and neither is Kayla.
So
you got a boob diva on your hands too, huh?
I will share my story a little bit. Okay, so I had a funny story, but I did nurse with both of my kids. And I supplemented in the early stages with both of the girls, and for interesting reasons. Like with my first daughter, I was inexperienced, and so she was nursing. And then when I was handing her to family members, give them a bottle. At that point in my motherhood journey, it didn't really matter. We nursed, she drank from a bottle, she had formula. We just got through that whole first year. But I also knew that I wanted to try for a second. So I knew that I wanted to wean her sooner rather than later, because I wanted to try when she got to be a year old, and I wanted my body to rebalance and go back. So that was my experience with my first. With my second, knowing that it was like the end of my journey, I was done having kids, I was just like, we're going to do this. And so now, remember I told you my second was 5 pounds, 12 ounces. So she was relatively small, but I was like, we're going to nurse. So nurse her a little bit, but because she was small and before she could go home, she had to pass her first test ever, which was the car seat test. So because they had to make sure that she can maintain her bodily vitals in the car seat. So I'm nursing, trying to nurse, and I know that she's hungry, but she's getting colostrum, whatever. So they're like, okay, I'm ready to go home. They're like, we need to test her. So they take her. They're like, she has to be fed before she can test. So I'm like, and so then send her away. I knew she was going to come back. So they came back. They was like, no, she's crying. She won't stay. You have to feed her. And I was like, I just want to take my baby and go home. I was like, give me the formula. Bring it here. Gave her the formula. She passed her test. We went home. Now, I will say this. So we are just about at the tail end of our breastfeeding journey. So she's about 20, 21 months. I will tell anybody who is planning on breastfeeding to, one, give yourself some grace and space because it will take time. From both of my pregnancies, I'd say it took me about 6 to 8 weeks to get a routine established, to get the milk kind of flowing when we wanted it to flow, however many times the babies will feed a day. But I think some moms begin the breastfeeding journey with not realistic expectations that, one, you, if you stick with it, you will produce enough. You need to drink enough water and then get that journey going. But give yourself some grace and space and be patient with yourself. But I do have a question for you, Simone, pulling on your experience from being a doula. I am ready to start weaning. All of the SNC spaces that I've been in where people have breastfed up to this point, the approach is that you don't deny, you don't say no, but you don't offer. And I forget what that's called. But I wanted to ask you, because we did talk a little bit about this when I first decided I wanted to start dating and I wanted to wean. You had mentioned something about gentle weaning. Can you talk a little bit about that? For someone who is ready to end the breastfeeding journey, what's the best way to go about that?
I'm going to say something you don't want to hear, Aisha.
I know.
The best way to go about weaning is to let the child wean by themselves. Then you won't have a problem weaning at all. I think that's honestly the best way to do it. That's not gentle weaning. That's just natural weaning. There is a time where children are done and then they'll be done. But if you can't wait for that time for whatever reason, then I would recommend what you just talked about, which is don't deny, don't offer, make sure you cover up, give lots of cuddles. I would say try to save the night feeding fight for the end or in the beginning, because that's going to be the hardest one.
Yeah, that's where we're at. It'll
be the most difficult thing for you to end. But there are also so many benefits to breastfeeding. So a toddler, because it, especially that's about where you are, right? Where I am.
She bites.
The teeth though,
right?
Yeah, but you also have a magic, I call it my magic wand, where you just wave it over the baby and all the tantrums.
Yes, there.
Yeah, it works perfectly with mine. Mine is very much of a boo baby and will stop in the middle of a tantrum and say like milk and get super excited.
That's awesome.
I'm going to keep going. But if you want to stop, I would say do it the easiest way possible and have conversations with your child, be kind, and remember that developmentally, this is not normal for them, that you're forcing them to do something that developmentally is against what they want to do, what they're designed to do, really.
So part of the other motivating factor is that mama is looking to get out to date again. And one of my things is I want to be maybe like a few months done past weaning, which gets me into the summertime. But I'm like, milk still be.
Yeah, milk. Some people stop breastfeeding and they still produce milk years later. So milk could still be there even after you wean.
What I wanted to hear.
I know it's not what you wanted to hear, but it could happen. And it's totally.
So if you let the baby wean, then does the milk go away?
I would say it dries up a lot easier. Yeah, because number one, they're gradually weaning. It's not an all of a sudden thing. And it's not something that you're designing. It's something that they've chosen to do. And some babies wean at 13 months. Other babies wean at 4. You don't know. I always look at it. Hera said, if we're in a pandemic, the last thing I want to do is give my child a disadvantage to healing.
So thank you for indulging my embarrassment. I'm blushing. We have also had conversations about you talk about where the babies are developmentally. We talk quite a bit about where the kids are developmentally due to this pandemic. And so I think one of the other expectations I'd like to talk about are academic expectations, right? Some of the things that we are expecting of our kids. I know this week has been particularly hard and challenging for me, where I've had to have a mommy get in the corner moment and figure this out. Because I was like, I know. Because look, my kids, they run the house. I know. It's just easier for me to go in a corner and figure it out. But I've been really struggling with the whole pandemic schooling and the expectations that I have and externally have, because I think that I'm a bit more balanced in knowing that the pandemic has inserted itself into where my daughter would be academically. And I've been trying to be easy about that. But then I get the voices in my ear from outside. Okay, so what is she doing? What are you doing? What could we be doing better to help? And all those little voices. And so I've had conversations with you about having appropriate developmental expectations for the kids. So can you talk about that a little bit?
I'm also a teacher, right? So I think I learned about appropriate developmental expectations through teaching. I came into teaching feeling like everybody should know what I'm talking about. The kids should know what to do. I should be in charge and I'm the adult and you're the child and that type of attitude. And that just didn't work. So I started doing a lot of research on what was developmentally normal. And I, as a parent now, I also am a firm believer that capitalism pushes us, because we all just talked about different capitalistic things, right? Heather, you talked about your job. Aisha, you talked about even dating, the expectations that we have for ourselves as women and within capitalism too, has pushed us into unrealistic expectations for our children. And we end up passing on a lot of that stress to our kids. We end up giving them unrealistic expectations for them to grow up and be independent, to sleep alone, to eat alone, to be independent after newborn. Like, why is this baby all on me? And I need you to back up. But developmentally, that's not normal. Children are one of the most dependent animals on the planet for the longest. And I think that we need to, as Black women, I really believe that we need to accept that because we're doing a disservice to our children, I believe at least, by creating unrealistic expectations to where they cannot reach. We expect our children to do things they can't do, and it's harmful. And that's the most important thing. I think especially for gender, like I'm writing a book right now. It's called How to Raise Boys That Don't Break. And it's about fragile masculinity and how to raise children who are resistant to it. How to raise boys, because we often, gender has a lot to do with that too, what the expectations are for our children. So I think it's definitely a topic I want to continue to talk about. And I think that Black women need to be talking about this as mothers, about how do we raise children who are developmentally safe, normal, and that we know that they love, that they know that we love them unconditionally. I'd be excited to. Thank you.
Simone, thank you for accepting our invitation to come and talk about your experience as an SMC. When your book comes out, come back and talk with us. Thank you for sharing your insights with our pod. Thank you for spending this time of your day to just come and just listen in on our girlfriend conversation. So again, we appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Start to Finish Motherhood with Aisha. If you want to keep the conversation going, follow Start to Finish Motherhood on Instagram or email me at aisha@starttofinishmotherhood.com. If you love this episode, please share it with anyone who's thinking of becoming a single mother by choice, anyone who's already parenting as a single mother by choice and just looking for advice on navigating it all, or a friend or family member who's looking to support someone else's single mother by choice journey. Until next time, bye now.